Good morning.
Morning.
Welcome to our Zoom conference for oral argument. Before we begin this morning, our marshal is going to show you all how we keep time, and you will have to kind of keep track of looking at the screen. So when it's time for you to begin, you will see this, a green start, okay? When you have 5 minutes to go, you have a yellow sign, and then when you need to conclude, it's a red stop sign. And I know it's sometimes hard to keep track of that when you're focused on your argument. So if you get beyond the stop sign and you're continuing to argue your case to us, if you're answering a justice's question, of course, I'll let you complete it. But other than that, I will try to hold you to the time limit so that you both are treated the same way. Are you both ready to begin this morning?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Then I will call our first case of the day, State versus Mercado. Counsel, if you are ready to begin, please do.
Good morning. I'm Assistant Attorney General Scott Rosenau for the state of Wisconsin. Young children are perhaps the most vulnerable members of our society. Wisconsin law gives trial courts broad leeway to admit children's out-of-court statements into evidence, allowing their voices to be heard. In 1985, in response to epidemic levels of child abuse in our state, our legislature enacted WISSTAT 90808. The statute helps ensure that trained professionals interview abused children using evidence-based techniques to elicit complete and truthful statements. The purpose of this statute is to make it easier to admit those reliable statements into evidence. When this statute doesn't apply, a court may rely on any other applicable hearsay exception to admit a child's out-of-court statements into evidence. In the 1988 case, State versus Sorensen, this court recognized the compelling need to introduce these vital statements into evidence.
Counsel, can I ask you to address, I think we know the background behind 90808. And your statement is that it's to make it easier to give another option and an understanding, but if we are to accept the argument in this case that residual hearsay allows the statements to come in, doesn't that kind of swallow up 90808? Why would you go through the hoops of 90808 if you could just get it in under residual hearsay?
Well, I don't think that either one swallows the other one. I think that they're just independent freestanding exceptions. And I think subsection 7 of the statute, 90808, recognizes that any other applicable hearsay exception can apply even if the statute doesn't. So I think even if the statute doesn't allow all three of the victims' videos to be admitted, I think the residual hearsay exception would in this case. In other cases, maybe the residual hearsay exception would not apply, but the statute would. So I think each of them is a freestanding hearsay exception that applies independently of the other one, or at least potentially can apply.
And so I have a question on the forfeiture issue here. Is it the state's position that the Court of Appeals should not have addressed these objections or could not have? In other words, is the statute here mandatory that, this court, under the rules of evidence may not, or the Court of Appeals may not address the merits of these objections this way, or that it has the discretion to do so as it did?
The state's position is that the Court of Appeals has no discretion to directly review the merits of this type of objection. And that's the same holding this court reached in State versus Schumacher with respect to a different forfeiture statute, that one involving forfeited objections to jury instructions. And the state is simply asking the court to extend Schumacher to forfeited objections to evidence being admitted.
And would you then look at the state's potential forfeiture different than your own? How would you respond to the argument, well, the state didn't raise these arguments initially in the post-conviction motion, and how would you distinguish that from the statute?
So I do realize that the state didn't raise these same exact forfeiture arguments regarding the issues that are before this court at the circuit court level, but it's well established going back to, I believe, State versus Holt in 1985, that the respondent can raise alternative grounds for affirming on appeal, even if they weren't raised in the circuit court. So I don't think the state forfeited its forfeiture arguments by not raising them in the circuit court. And I know that Your Honor wasn't exactly asking about the Court of Appeals level, but I do just want to throw this out there just for transparency and for sake of clarity. In the Court of Appeals, the state did argue that these same objections were forfeited because they weren't timely made at trial. But the nature of their argument was a little bit different. The state did not argue that the Court of Appeals lacked the authority to address the merits directly, simply because binding precedent treats for these types of forfeited objections as something the Court of Appeals can overlook in its discretion. So the state is asking the court to break some new ground in this case, which the Court of Appeals lacked the authority to do. So I guess the exact nature of the forfeiture argument is a little different before this court than it was before the Court of Appeals, but the same general argument, the same general forfeiture argument was raised in both courts.
Why should we extend that argument to a case like this in this statute?
I think the big reason why is because this forfeiture rule is not, I think, what's called a rule of judicial administration, which I think essentially means a common law rule. Because in this case, there is a forfeiture statute, and in Schumacher, that seemed to be the distinguishing linchpin, I guess, of that case, that there it's not just a common law rule that parties have to timely object to jury instructions. There's a statute that says they have to, and if they don't, the statute says the objection is waived. The same thing is true in this case. There's a statute that says when a court admits evidence or excludes evidence, there has to be a timely objection, otherwise the objection is waived. So I think it's really a statutory rule. It's not a common law rule. So I think that's what makes a difference here.
I want to ask about the various grounds just going to the issue. If we accepted your argument and we're just looking at the one video that was objected to, how would you rank the different arguments that you make that support its admission? What do you think is your strongest argument that you have?
So to be clear, are you talking about the youngest victim's video? Okay.
Yes.
So to be clear, Mercado did object to the, I guess we can call it the middle-aged victim's video as well, pre-trial. He just didn't. So he argued under 90808 subsection 3C that the two youngest victims' videos were inadmissible, but he did not renew that 3C argument on appeal. So he forfeited that 3C argument with respect to the middle-aged victim on appeal, and he forfeited certain other objections at the trial level, which is partly why this case is so complex, because there are multiple, I guess, layers of forfeiture or forfeiture at different levels. But putting all that aside, I will address the youngest victim's video. So this is an LG that we're talking about. So I think that probably the easiest way, if this court is looking for a narrow ground for reversing, I think the narrowest, perhaps least groundbreaking rationale would be the residual hearsay exception. And that one applies to all three videos. It seems to be a pretty straightforward application of Sorensen and Huntington. I'd say this the second easiest, or maybe the easiest way with respect to just the youngest victim, is the prior inconsistent statement rationale. I don't think that would be very groundbreaking or very complex either. But to be clear, that rationale applies only to the youngest victim, because she testified before her video was admitted and she testified inconsistently with the video. So I think either of those would be pretty simple. The 90808 rationale would also apply to all three victims' videos, but that rationale is pretty complex because the statute applies differently to the various victims based on which arguments were preserved at trial, based on which arguments were preserved on appeal, and just the facts of the three videos and how they were admitted differ. So the statutory ground is probably the most difficult and most complex for any of the three victims, especially the youngest one, because most of the statutory issues are raised with respect to the youngest victim.
Can you tell me?
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. I want to talk about meaningful cross-examination as it relates to the youngest victim, NLG. Tell me how she was available for a meaningful cross.
So I don't think that there is a right to a meaningful or successful cross-examination. There's only a constitutional and I believe also statutory right to an opportunity for meaningful cross-examination. And I think that opposing trial counsel, Attorney Bowie, I think she did have a meaningful opportunity to cross-examine the youngest victim. So there are a couple things about her cross-examination, I think, that are worth noting. One is that the NLG either didn't remember or said she didn't remember this interview. And she even said that she never talked to this detective, even though on direct examination a minute earlier, she said that she had talked to this detective. So I think that there's a lack of memory, and that is one potential concern. But I think that I would encourage the court to look at State versus Roquette. I believe I cited it in my reply brief in response to some constitutional concerns that were raised in their response brief. Roquette is a 2006, I think, or 2005 Court of Appeals case that goes over lack of memory with respect to the right to cross-examine, and it talks about Crawford. So basically, in the Crawford case, I'm sure everyone on this court is familiar with it. I believe it's from 2004, a pretty groundbreaking U.S. Supreme Court case that changed the law of confrontation. In that decision, there's a footnote where the court, I believe it's footnote 8 maybe, in Crawford, where the court says a witness's testimonial out-of-court statement has no confrontation implications if that witness is available to testify. And the court didn't really explain what that means in Crawford. So in the Roquette case, our Court of Appeals looked at some earlier SCOTUS cases from the 1980s. Fensterer, I believe, is one, and Owens is the other one, which held that a witness's lack of memory has no Sixth Amendment confrontation concerns. So I don't think that there is any constitutional concern with respect to the youngest victim's lack of memory. And just to be clear, there is no constitutional issue being raised before this court. Mercado didn't preserve a constitutional objection at the trial level, I don't think, and certainly not in the Court of Appeals. And it's not an issue before this court, and he's not developing a constitutional argument either. But I realize that some of these constitutional concerns might be relevant to the statutory analysis of whether there was, like subsection 5A gives him the right to cross-examine the victim, and some other provisions also in the 90808 require her to be available to testify and require a meaningful opportunity to address her statement, basically. And I think that, my first point is lack of memory doesn't matter. Second point is that I think trial counsel basically just gave up on cross-examination and just sort of threw her hands in the air and said, there's no point in trying this further, even though the circuit court judge said, there are things you could do to further cross-examine the victim if you want. You could play the video while the victim watches it. You could see if it refreshes her recollection, then try to talk to her about it. You could ask her about the body diagram where she marked where the defendant had been touching her. And there are other avenues for cross-examination too. For example, trial counsel cross-examined the two older victims and raised the inference that they were maybe colluding on their stories and asked the older victims questions like, did your mom tell you what to do or tell you what to say? Did you talk to your mom about this stuff? Did you talk to your sisters? Were all of your sisters present when you were sharing these accusations? And trial counsel never tried to explore those possible grounds for exploring credibility with respect to the youngest victim. She basically got a few answers that she didn't like, saying, I don't remember, and she just threw her hands up and quit. So I think she had the opportunity for meaningful cross-examination. She just declined the opportunity. And to be clear, there is no ineffective assistance claim being raised here either. So trial counsel's performance is not an issue.
In answer to Justice Hagedorn's question, one of the ways we thought we could go was to just say these statements come in under 90808. And I'm only referring to the two younger kids' statements because I think the older one, there's a different argument potentially. But tell us how this would fit under 90808, given that sub 1 sub C requires the child's understanding that false statements are punishable and of the importance of telling the truth, and both of those kids really had no ability to say that on the video.
Sure. So a couple of things about 90808-3C. One is that we're only addressing the youngest victim's video, I believe, in this court. Like I said, I think I said to Justice Hagedorn a few minutes ago that Mercado did object pretrial to the middle-aged victim, and her initials are LAG. He did object to her video pretrial under subsection 3C, but he didn't raise that argument on appeal, so it's forfeited, and he didn't really develop the argument in this court either. So I think this court should focus only on the youngest victim's video under subsection 3C. And I'll admit that her video is on the thinnest grounds, I suppose, under 3C. So if her video is admissible under 3C, then the middle-aged victim's video would be as well. And Mercado conceded pretrial that the oldest victim's video satisfied 3C. So I think a couple important things to keep in mind about 3C. One is that I think it's a clearly erroneous standard of review. I don't think it's de novo. And I think that this court should look at not only the video statements NLG's forensic interview video, but also look at her colloquy with the court. She had a colloquy, I believe it was two different days. I think it was the end of day two and the start of day three. And she stumbled a little bit in terms of the truth versus lie distinction at the end of day two, but at the beginning of day three, her answers were really good. And I think there are some things to keep in mind about this youngest victim. One is that she was barely 4 years old when she made this video, and she was about 4 and a half when she testified at trial. And I think she said that she didn't know the difference between a truth and a lie a couple times, and same thing about real versus imaginary. But I think that's just because her vocabulary was very limited, so she maybe didn't really know what the word truth means. And honestly, truth is a pretty complex concept that even adults grasp and philosophers grasp with it. So I can't blame the 4-year-old for not really knowing what truth means. But I think even though she claimed to not know what truth versus lie meant, she demonstrated otherwise. She demonstrated that she did know the distinction, even though she didn't claim to know it. So I think maybe she just doesn't know what those words mean. And when there was some discussion about right and wrong, she seemed to have a better grasp on what those words meant than truth versus lie. And I think she demonstrated adequately that she knew the difference by pointing out colors of things in the room, pointing out the judge's robe color, that sort of thing. And again, it's a clearly rolling a standard. The judge was the one, the Judge Conan was the one in the courtroom both of those days going through these colloquies. He could see her inflection. He could see her demeanor. And I think judging on those things, he could adequately say that she knew the difference.
So it's your argument, counsel, just so I'm clear, that when you're looking at 3C, you're looking at their understanding period. You're not limited to the video and the understanding that they gave during the video, because you do agree during the video, she had a total inability to really talk about those things. But you're saying that because she was questioned on the stand, the court can take that in consideration?
I think even if you look just at the video, and even if you apply de novo review, which arguably you should do just based on the video, which is what Jimmy RR says, but as I point out in my brief, I think that's wrong. I think it's clearly erroneous standard of review no matter what. But even if you look at just the video and apply de novo review, I still think the victim's video, the youngest victim, NLG, I still think it's good enough under 3C to come in, because Jimmy RR set a really low bar for admissibility under 3C. The victim and Jimmy RR simply, I think, answered one or two questions correctly involving the color of something in the room or color of the, I think it was the color of the interviewer's shirt or something. And also, the Court of Appeals in that case relied on the atmosphere. It was a government building with a stranger asking the young child about sensitive subjects. And the court said those one or two correct answers combined with this environment were good enough under 3C, under de novo review.
But in Jimmy RR, aren't they talking about the interview itself and not what happened in the courtroom? I'm having a hard time, I think, along with Justice Dell, just following your argument. And I'm looking on page 21 of your brief, and it says that the plain language, and you're talking about 90808-3C, says that a circuit court must make a finding under that section at trial. So I'm not sure exactly what you're saying. I understand that it needs to be made at trial, because I don't know, as a judge obviously could make it before trial or at trial. But aren't we talking about that oath or affirmation at the time of the video?
I think that under 3C, the trial court can look at the video or look at a courtroom colloquy during the trial if it conducts one like it did here. I think the difference in Jimmy RR is that, and this is page 21 of my brief again, the red brief.
Yep.
In Jimmy RR, the Court of Appeals applied de novo review because it said the only evidence on this question is the videotape. So I think that that language in Jimmy RR suggests that if there were other evidence beyond the videotape, such as a courtroom colloquy, like in this case, then the judge could rely on the colloquy in addition to the video itself.
And so let me just stop you there. So many times in these cases, there is a period of time between the interview and the trial, right? And we're talking about young kids. We could be talking about an interview when it was NLG 3 or 4 at the time of the interview. And then by the time that the trial happened, she was, I think, 5, perhaps. Those 3 to 5 in developmentally for children is huge, right? So I'm having a hard time with your conclusion that a colloquy at trial would substantiate that a child knew at the time of the interview that the video was made, that at that time they were able to ascertain the difference between the truth and a lie. And I could not possibly agree with you more about the importance of being sure that young children are able to see justice when they are victims of sexual assault. So I agree with the reason that we have the statute. I just don't see how you're reading the statute to come to the conclusion you have on page 21.
Sure. So a couple of things about 3C and the youngest victim. So she was, I believe, 4 years and 1 month old when the video was made. There was a trial about a month or two later that ended in a mistrial because an interpreter wasn't available for Mercado. The next trial was in January. So the interview was done in August 2016. I believe she was born July 2016. The next trial, the second one, the one that we're looking at here, that was January 2017. So the youngest victim was about 4.5 years old. So only about 6 months had passed. Sure, that's still a lot of developmental time for somebody that young. But I think the age of the victim and the gap between the interview and the trial, certainly something the circuit court can consider in its discretion when deciding to do the colloquy. But one or two more points I want to make about the subsection 3C. Mercado doesn't dispute in his response brief that we can look at the colloquy at trial to see whether 3C was satisfied. And in fact, Mercado looks at the colloquy and says the colloquy supports his argument that 3C is not satisfied because he points to things the youngest victim said at trial, where she said she doesn't know the difference between a truth and a lie, that sort of thing. A couple more things. I think the video still is sufficient under the low bar set in Jimmy RR. The youngest victim still identified a wall as a wall, a pillow as a pillow. She said a light-colored wall was yellow. She said a dark-colored pillow was blue, which is pretty close to what the colors were. And I think that even though she said a few things wrong, I think a couple things to keep in mind. When looking at the video, she had to go to the bathroom. She was a little squirrely. She ended up using a bathroom break shortly after this truth versus lie discussion. So I think maybe her full attention wasn't being given to these questions. Same sorts of concerns on day one of the trial in the afternoon. She had sat through an entire day of trial. It was late in the afternoon. She was probably ready to go home, probably tired. And that's when her answers weren't very good. She said something's right, something's wrong at the end of day two. Start of day three, her answers were very good. It was early in the morning and she was fresh. So I think those are some things to keep in mind. Also about the victim, in terms of, I think if you look at the video or even the trial colloquies, I think she got a little hung up on double negatives. Like when she was asked, do you promise you won't lie? And she said, no. And then the judge clarified what she meant. And she said, she does promise. I think when she said no, I think she meant, no, I won't lie. Same sort of thing maybe with respect to some of the questions, like, would it be wrong if I said my robe was black? And she might have said no to some question of that nature maybe once. And I think what she meant was, no, it's not green, or no, this wall isn't black or something. So if the interviewer said, is it wrong to say this? And she says no, I don't think she means, no, it's not wrong. I think she means, no, your robe isn't green. So I think this concept of double negatives was hanging her up a little bit, considering that she's 4 years old, had a pretty limited vocabulary, even for somebody who's that age. So I think those are things the court should keep in mind that just to be clear, even under the video, even under de novo review, I think her video satisfies 3C, but I think the court should look at the colloquy in the courtroom, and I think it should apply the clearly erroneous standard because Judge Conan was able to see her demeanor, see her inflections in her voice when she was giving these answers. And we haven't talked about residual hearsay at all. And I realize that I'm running out of time before opposing counsel gets to go. So I guess I'll reserve my residual hearsay for the rebuttal. But I do want to very briefly talk about the oldest victim. And the state's position is the court should uphold all three convictions. But I think it's 100% clear that this court absolutely should uphold the conviction regarding the oldest victim, OEG. And just looking at the court of appeals decision, it really had no basis for reversing that conviction. For under residual hearsay, all the court of appeals said about the oldest victim is the trial court didn't satisfy 2B of the statute because it didn't watch the oldest victim's video before trial. But I think for one thing, that was harmless error, if it was error at all, because her video still would have come in had it watched the whole thing. Second thing is nobody ever objected. Mercado didn't object to the oldest victim's video pre-trial, so there was no reason to watch it pre-trial. And third, I think even if 2B of the statute wasn't satisfied, that has no bearing on the residual hearsay analysis, which is an entirely separate thing. So I think the Court of Appeals was really, really far off when it reversed the oldest victim's conviction. And I'm out of time, so I'll save the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Counsel?
Okay.
Please proceed.
May it please the court. I am, good morning, first of all. I am Esther Cohn Lee, attorney for the defendant Angel Mercado. And I'd like to begin by discussing the admission into evidence of the three recordings of the children, beginning with recording of NG. And both the state and the dissent in the Court of Appeals have agreed that the admission of NG's recording had been properly objected to by defense counsel. The bottom line regarding the admission of NG's recording is that under Crawford and Green, United States Supreme Court has forbidden a situation where a 59-year-old man is convicted and given a life sentence, which is what this 32-year sentence was for this man, on the basis of a recording of a 4-year-old child who was not testifying under oath and who did not show that she understood the difference between the truth and a lie or that she could be punished for not telling the truth. And that she also, the version that she gave in regard to what had happened between her and the defendant had never been cross-examined, not during the recording itself and not during her trial testimony.
Counsel, normally in these situations, there was some dispute, I think, over standard of review. Do you agree with your opposing counsel that these are, in the main here, subject to the erroneous exercise of discretion standard of review?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch
you. I'm sorry, did you agree that our review is based on an erroneous exercise of discretion? The trial court had discretion to make this decision.
The trial court had the discretion to make the decision as to whether or not NG's recording should be admitted?
Correct.
The fact is that the statute requires 908.08 subdivision 3C requires that the court either find that she was speaking under oath, which she wasn't, or that she understood the importance of telling the truth, and that her she could be punished if she didn't tell the truth. And that recording and that decision had to be made on the basis of her recording, not on the basis of her trial testimony.
Let me talk about briefly your opposing counsel. I hear the statutory argument, but let me narrow down a little bit. He mentioned that the statute even provides that these things could be admitted under one of the other exceptions to the hearsay rule. He thought the strongest, cleanest argument was residual hearsay. Do you agree that admission under the residual hearsay exception is for an erroneous exercise of discretion?
Well, First of all, Your Honor, I don't believe that it should be coming in under the residual hearsay exception. And the reason is, Your Honor, that the state had enacted 908.08, which was enacted in 1985 before Crawford, but after Green, it was trying to provide a procedure that would allow these recordings to come in order to help young children be able to have their accusations considered. But at the same time, the legislature realized that it had to take steps in that statute to protect the defendant's right to confrontation. Under the residual hearsay exception, there is no such procedure. And so, in fact, I noticed in the dissent in the Court of Appeals, they didn't even mention they didn't discuss the residual hearsay exception. And also, the videos were not offered at the trial on the ground of the residual hearsay exception. They were accepted under 908.08, which was incorrect. But the fact is that residual hearsay exception was never meant to override the protections that were in 908.08.
Counsel, what about the prior inconsistent statement? As I recall, the majority in the Court of Appeals agreed with you regarding the interpretation of 908.083C, but the dissent said, but look, with regard to the youngest child, it can come in under prior inconsistent statement. Can you respond to that?
The prior inconsistent statement, in order to come in as that, first of all, even I should say this, on November 8th at the pretrial hearing, when they were discussing whether or not it could come in as a prior inconsistent statement, the trial court even said, yes, maybe it could come in, but it would have to be that the witness had to testify and had to be subject to cross-examination about the statement, which it was not here. And the prior inconsistent statement under the statute may only come in if the witness testifies and is cross-examined about the statement. And then there's an inconsistency between her testimony and the prior statement. Here, there was no inconsistency because the statement at the trial was she would not acknowledge that she had spoken to Dan, the person who interviewed her, about anything that happened between her and the defendant. So you don't have anything that is inconsistent with her statement coming in at the trial. So it can't come in as a prior inconsistent statement.
Ms. Lee, isn't the state law in Wisconsin under Lenarchek that if in this case, a victim takes the stand or a witness takes a stand and they continue to say, I don't remember or I don't recall, that can be viewed as an inconsistent statement. And and then you are able to impeach them with, in this case, it would have been the statement of her from the videotape. How do you differentiate what happened in this case? That is, how do you differentiate NLG's testimony from the testimony in Lenarchek?
Well, Your Honor, the fact is you're still dealing here with the confrontation clause. It's much different than other types of situations. And if she is making an accusation in the recording and now she comes to trial and says, well, I don't remember anything about that, there can be no cross-examination. And that's absolutely essential to being allowing the recording to come in.
So if I understand your argument is that not only does a defendant have a right to confront, in this case, his accuser, but now we are telling the accuser that they must testify to certain things?
Well, they must testify about, or at least answer questions about the recording, because now, you know, Your Honor, what you have here is the jury hearing this recording. And never at any point was defense counsel, did they have the opportunity to cross-examine her about those specific accusations. And so now you have the defendant being convicted solely on the basis of what is the Crawford court would call testimonial hearsay. And that violates his right to confrontation.
Well, I'm pretty sure in Crawford, the witness there, the victim, was not available to be cross-examined. In this case, NLG certainly was available. NLG was in the courtroom. The judge told NLG to stay there, is my understanding. And then the defense attorney chose not to cross-examine her. It's a completely different set of facts than under Crawford.
Well, let me just explain that. Crawford did cite Green. And in Green, the court said the statement, the out-of-court statement, could not be admitted unless it was subject to full and effective cross-examination. And here, there was no full and effective cross-examination. There couldn't be, because what was defense counsel supposed to ask her? How many times could she ask her, do you remember what you said to the interviewer? And all she could answer is, I don't remember talking to him about this incident. So she never answered any specific questions about the recording, about the accusations, let's put it that way. And it's the accusations that have to be cross-examined. That's what those cases hold.
Counsel, just two quick follow-up questions to the questions of my colleagues. On the admission for a prior and consistent statement, would you agree that our review of that would be for an erroneous exercise of discretion?
Let me just see here. They never offered, let's start with this. They never offered those statements to come in as prior inconsistent statements during the trial. And so the trial court never ruled that they were coming in as prior inconsistent statements. And so now the statements, you know, as the majority held, they really cannot come in as prior inconsistent statements. It's not a question of was there erroneous exercise of discretion in allowing them to come in. The fact is that really the statute does not allow them to come in, that they're supposed to come in only if they follow the procedures set forth in 908.08.
Okay, my follow-up question then, you did not make in your brief, I certainly did not see any constitutional argument regarding Crawford that was developed in any meaningful way. I guess I'm not sure exactly what you're wanting us to do with that when it doesn't appear that it was developed in your briefs.
Well, I did discuss it, and I also cited Green. And the fact is that the issue has to do with the defendant's right to confrontation. And so there's really no getting around he was entitled to, in fact, I noticed that the state constitution, Article 1, Section 7, is even more specific than the United States Constitution. It says that the accused shall enjoy the right to meet his accusers face to face. And we're missing that here. And so if you're going to allow these recordings to come in, they must come in accordance with a statute that was developed to protect that right.
Counsel, given the sentencing structure of the trial court, it seems to me that you need to make a strong argument regarding count 2, LAG. What is your strongest argument there?
Okay. During the November 8th pretrial hearing, they were discussing the fact that NG might not be able to answer any questions, or might not answer any questions on cross-examination, and that therefore her recording would not be admissible. And Ms. Bowie said, well, the same would be true as to LG. because she might not answer any questions on cross. And not only that, LG's recording showed that she did not believe that it was important to tell the truth, and she would not promise to tell the truth. And so the court ruled, when it was ruling about whether or not the recordings would be admissible, he ruled as to both NG and LG. Now, she didn't mention it again at the trial, but there is a case, Coots, that held that if you object to the admission of evidence at a pretrial hearing and the court overrules your objection, which the court did on November 9th at the beginning of the first trial, you do not have to raise it again at the trial. I think I'd also like to discuss the fact that the court ordered NG to testify first and then have her recording played and then have her recalled to testify on cross-examination about the recording. And subdivision 5 says that the court, that if the court rules that the child's recording is admissible, the state shall call or may call the child as a witness after the statement is shown to the jury. And the majority held that that statute is mandatory and that the court violated it, citing James. And I noticed that the state is asking that the court overrule James. But James is really an important case. It was decided in 2005, 1 year after Crawford. And it discussed at great length Crawford, because it recognized that if the recording is played first and then the child refuses to be cross-examined about it or refuse to answer questions about it, that would constitute a Crawford violation and would require a mistrial. And the court held that if there is a mistrial, then so be it, because the legislature had required the recording to be played first, because if you allow it to happen the way the court did in this case, it would require the child to testify twice. And that's exactly what the legislature did not want to happen. And the fact that there might be a possibility that there would be a mistrial if you played the recording first, that is not something that would prevent the court from following the dictates of the statute. And then in regard to the issue about the fact that the court failed to review all of the recordings in their entirety before ruling that they're admissible, subdivision 2 requires that the court hold a hearing before trial to determine the admissibility of the statutes of the recordings, and that at or before that hearing, the court is to view the statement. And the majority held that that statute is mandatory, and that what the legislature was saying was, if the court is going to allow the defendant to be convicted on the basis of a recording, at the very least, the court must view the entire recording before showing the entire recording to the jury.
And I want to ask you a question about that in your brief. As I understand your argument, part of it is that it would be the job of the judge then to determine whether or not the video has been altered or distorted. Do I have that right?
Right.
How in the world would a trial court judge have any idea if the video has been altered or distorted? Wouldn't that be the job of the defense attorney? The trial court judge would not have been present when the video interview had been initially conducted. How would the judge know?
Well, Your Honor, all I can say is that Section 908.08, I think it's subdivision B, requires the court to make that determination. And then subdivision D said also he's required, or the court is required to determine whether it has it had indicia of truthfulness. And the third thing is the court is to decide or determine whether or not the child understood the difference between the truth and a lie. So what the majority pointed out here was that those determinations could not have been made if the court only viewed a few minutes of the recording of NG and LG and none of the recording of OG. Okay, then the next issue I'd like to discuss then is the issue of forfeiture. In regard to the issues that the court, first of all, like I said, the issue of NG and LG's recordings had been preserved. And I think even the state has argued that that's true. In regard to the issues that had not been preserved, the forfeiture rule, the majority held that it was going to review those issues anyway, the forfeiture rule is a rule of judicial administration and the court could choose to disregard it in an appropriate case. Here it chose to not apply it because it held that the only evidence against the defendant were these recordings. And so that it was imperative that the trial court review those issues and make sure that the circuit court had followed the dictates of the statute. And also, again, the issue of forfeiture had not been raised by the state in response to the post-conviction motion. And as a result, the circuit court, when it decided the post-conviction motion, never even mentioned the issue of forfeiture. And I noticed that in Nadina, I think, which is the case that talked about the importance of the forfeiture rule, it even said, if the state does not raise the issue of forfeiture in the circuit court, they may lose the right to raise it later on. On the question that the state and the dissent raised was whether the Court of Appeals had the authority to disregard the forfeiture rule. And of course, it has already been held by the courts that it does have that authority. I think it was Kosmarski, which was cited in the majority. And then of course it was Cooper and Coynahan in this court, which was just decided this year. And in the concurring opinion in Coynahan, the court was saying, well, the disregarding of the forfeiture rule was being done inconsistently and that there were no clear rules as to when that would occur. But in response to that, I want to argue that the court has discretionary, there are statutes that give the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court discretionary power to disregard the forfeiture rule. And in those cases, except for finding that the forfeiture rule could be disregarded if when there was a real controversy of the case that had not been fully tried or when a miscarriage of justice had occurred for any reason. In those cases, there are no clear rules as when the discretionary power may be used either. So I think this has to be done on a case-by-case basis. And the majority has held that one of the factors that would lead to disregarding the forfeiture rule is when the trial court failed to abide by the only statute in the state that would allow these recordings to be received in evidence and at the same time protect the defendant's right to confrontation. I don't know, let's see here. Let me see if I can address some of the arguments of the state here. He talked about how defense counsel had given up cross-examining NG, but she didn't give up on it. She just had nothing to say, nothing to ask her about. If she's making statements, the court held that it was going to allow the cross-examination, that there had been, he talked about meaningful opportunity to cross-examination, but there is no meaningful opportunity if the witness is saying, well, that didn't happen, or I don't remember that happening, that there's no way, there's nothing that the defense attorney could have brought out that would have protected, or that would have given information anymore about the accusation.
Counsel, what about the offer that was made by the circuit court to have the youngest child testify again after the video so that counsel could ask the younger child who was in the courtroom when the video was played, do you remember saying this and then repeat what she said? What about going back to the video and asking her questions about the video?
Well, first of all, subdivision 5 had said you're not supposed to do it that way. You're not supposed to have the child testify first and then play the video.
I know, but I'm talking about the child testifying after the video was played. What about asking her questions about what she said during the video?
Well, the fact is that she had already made a statement that she didn't remember talking to Dan.
I know, but you could say, well, now that you've seen the video, do you remember telling the man you were speaking to and then repeat what she said?
Well,
it appears that the questioning could only be worse for the defendant. I mean, if you're going to ask her, did you see the video? Was that you in the video? Well, were you talking to the interviewer? I mean, all of those questions are not helpful to the defendant. And it appeared to me that's why the defendant's counsel said, I'm not going to ask any more questions.
Well, I don't know. I think, Your Honor, that I think that she, once she said, I don't remember the video, I don't remember it. And I, not only that, she said, they asked her questions about, did you speak to him about what happened between you and the defendant in certain words? I can't remember the words exactly. And she said, no, that then what was defense counsel supposed to say?
Well, we use written statements of people to refresh their recollection all the time when they say they don't remember this or that. So to me, the video would stand in the same place as a written statement, if you had an older person who'd made it, to refresh their recollection about something they said that they didn't remember. So I'm not sure. Well, it just seems to me it was a missed opportunity. If there was a question that counsel really thought counsel could ask to get underneath the truthfulness of the youngest reporter.
Okay, well, in the end, though, Your Honor, you still have a situation where now you have this recording being the only basis for his conviction in regard to the accusation that she made. And so that was unconstitutional. That's what I was saying.
Okay.
Is it your position, are you saying that because of 90808's existence, that that's the only way that you can get in a video? I mean, it seems to me that's what you're saying. What if you couldn't or didn't want to go through 90808, or as in this case where you maybe didn't meet all the, check off all the boxes of 90808, it seems you're saying that's the only way that could be introduced, a video of a child. Couldn't it come in these other types of exceptions, such as residual hearsay or prior consistent statement, if it was appropriate?
Well, like I said, the protections, 908 was made or enacted to meet two goals, which was to allow the video to come in. It's testimonial hearsay, and there has to be protections for the way it comes in. And then the secondly, bringing it in a way that would protect the defendant's right to confrontation. The residual hearsay rule, the prior inconsistent statement rules, those were never meant to meet those two goals. And so they should not have been allowed to come in under those rules. Also, by the way, I happen to think of another thing. The residual hearsay rule lists 23 statements that could come in as exceptions to the hearsay rule. And then it says the 24th, other exceptions. And it talks about that other statements could come in under the residual hearsay rule if they if it met the circumstantial guarantee of trustworthiness. And there, first of all, I must say that Crawford said, we don't, trustworthiness and reliability of the statement, that doesn't matter. What matters is cross-examination. But the other thing is, there's two cases that talked about what the trustworthiness would be. That was Sorensen and Huntington. And in those cases, they list five factors to show the trustworthiness. And the very first factor they mentioned was that the court had to find that the child understood the importance of telling the truth, and that her she could be punished if she didn't tell the truth. And it also listed it as a factor that the court had to make a finding that the statement, that there were not statements, that the statement had not been false, find facts that the statement had been false. And the majority in this case held that, first of all, they didn't meet the first criteria, the first factor, and secondly, they couldn't possibly have met the second factor because the court had not reviewed the entire recordings of these three children.
And thank you, counsel. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Oh, am I done?
Yep, your time is up and has been for just a little bit. That's okay. I mean, this is a new system, so you're doing very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. So first of all, I just want to say that this court should not only reverse the Court of Appeals decision, but also make clear that it has no precedential value. The Court of Appeals decision is very far-reaching. It resolved a lot of issues of first impression. It resolved almost all of the arguments that Mercado raised on appeal in a far-reaching published decision. And the state's concern is that if this court reverses on a narrow ground, that the unreversed holdings will remain precedential unless this court says otherwise. And if it does adopt a narrow ground for reversing, it should say otherwise. It should say the Court of Appeals decision has no precedential value. Now, I've got sort of a laundry list of things to run through, so hopefully I can get through them pretty quickly. So,
would you address the Crawford issue?
That was number one on my list, Your Honor.
Okay.
So I think that there is no Crawford issue being presented to this court. There wasn't a Crawford issue adequately raised in the trial court or on appeal in the Court of Appeals or in the state's petition for review. And I don't think there's one being adequately developed in the defendant's blue brief before this court either. A couple other things about the confrontation non-issue. There is a case called State versus Richard Boie, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, B-O-I-E. A petition for review was filed in that case by the defendant earlier this year, I believe. I filed a response, a formal response saying, don't take the case because you took Mercado instead, which raises some similar issues. But the difference between this case and Boie is that Boie does raise a Crawford confrontation claim. So if the court really wants to address a confrontation claim with respect to videos admitted under 90808, finish your grant review in Boy and address the issue there, not in this case, because it's not being raised in this case. Third thing about confrontation, check out pages 3 and 9 of my gray reply brief. I cite James and Rockett, and I think under those cases, there is no confrontation problem here, even if the issue were being raised. I want to talk next about prior inconsistent statements. So the circuit court pre-trial did agree with the prosecutor that all three victims' videos could come in as prior consistent or inconsistent statements, depending on how the testimony went. And that's record item 71 at pages 18 to 19. I realize the state didn't rely on residual hearsay, that exception until post-conviction, but I think the reason why is because after Mercado was convicted, he raised several objections that he didn't timely raise before the trial ended. And it's basically that sandbagging litigation strategy by Mercado that prompted the state to rely on residual hearsay for the first time post-conviction. So I think it would be unfair to review the residual hearsay analysis de novo just because the trial court didn't consider it pre-trial. The reason it didn't is because Mercado didn't really adequately object to some of this stuff, and that's why the state had to rely on it as a fail-safe post-conviction. So I think the post-conviction court's residual hearsay assessment is still, it's good enough in the sense that this court should deferentially review the post-conviction court's residual hearsay ruling if it looks at that issue. A few other things quickly, if I have time.
What do you mean by erroneous exercise of discretion?
Yeah, so my point is, if this court does look at the residual hearsay exception to admit some or all of these videos, it should apply the erroneous exercise of discretion standard of review. It should not apply de novo review. And the question would be, what decision is it deferring to? It would technically be deferring to the post-conviction court's ruling, because that's when the court first addressed residual hearsay.
We have said in many cases that erroneous exercise of discretion is when a court misstates the fact or misstates the law, which inherently then brings into de novo review. Do you disagree with that?
No, I agree with that statement, but I don't think the circuit court misapplied the law. I think it reasonably applied the residual hearsay exception. One other point I wanted to make quickly is that Mercado forfeited his objections under subsection 2B and subsection 5A of the statute. And that's one way to dispose of those issues if the court wants to go down the path of 90808. But one other point about those two subsections, if the circuit court violated those provisions, the error was harmless. And the Court of Appeals harmless error analysis is really incorrect because it framed the issue as whether Mercado would have been convicted without the videos. But that's not the issue under sub 2B and sub 5A. Those are simply procedural mechanisms that the court has to go through when it's admitting a video. So had the court followed those allegedly correct procedures, the video still would have come in, so the error was harmless. And I see that I'm out of time. So I ask that this court reverse the Court of Appeals decision. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you both. You did a very good job, and the briefs were very helpful to the court. So we are now going to take a break until our second case of the morning, and we are adjourned.